Mr. Helps, Realto.
Right. Having before we could go across the Imjin River, the Americans built a pontoon bridge of inflatable dinghies with boards going across them, right across. Being the before the rains had come, the water level was then at that time pretty low, so it was fairly easy to go across. But the having gone across without, there was no attempt by the Chinese to defend the river at all, but they were in strength in the higher ground further north, and it was mainly to presumably deny the no man's land between the Commonwealth and American forces and the Chinese forces, which was a pretty wide area of I suppose 2 or 3 miles, which was patrolled intermittently by various people, but was far too wide an area to leave open, that the advance was made to close up to the Chinese forward positions and hopefully to push them back as far as we could go within the scope before winter came. And some fairly sharp engagements seemed to take place once contact had been made with the Chinese, so on their outposts and so on, they merely relinquished and moved back to their main positions. And it then became rather more difficult, I think, for the for infantry companies and so on to go forward. And some pretty sharp battles were made. And very often it seemed that they were, a position would be vacated, taken over by the forward companies, and then the actual battle would occur in the early evening when the Chinese would counterattack with vast numbers of people, loud noises and trumpetings and what have you, basically onto a piece of ground that they knew like the back of their hand, whereas the occupying troops who had just arrived there really didn't know the area of the thing or the layout of what foxholes and trenches there were there, or the position of any sort of minefields or booby traps or anything like that. And I think to a certain extent it was daylight fighting was fine, one knew what was going on, but at night it was not so good, and the Chinese were rather good at it. A lot of the right sort of noises, if there was time to put down wire and defences or something like that, perhaps a sentry was in that particular section and everything was quiet, and out of the dark would come a stone. If he wasn't a trained man or was a bit jumpy, perhaps inclined to fire there, as soon as he's fired he's given away, okay, that trench is occupied, there is a light weapon there, or perhaps an automatic weapon or something. The Chinese were very good at this sort of thing. The other thing was to sort of rattle tins or that sort of thing, because all our rations came up in little tins and they rather got thrown over the wire or over the hole into the forward area. And was it a Chinaman rattling the tin or was it some rats having a scratch around? You didn't know. And it was a little bit nerve-wracking for people at night when things were quiet. But this continued until we, pretty solid pressure, I suppose, went along all the way along the line, and advances were made. And on the right of our front was a hill which is known purely by its height of 355, which dominated a large amount of the area. And it had a little road going up on the left-hand side of it. And this feature was the one that eventually, I think this is the one that Speakman got his VC on. And it was during the advance to this lot that we ended up with, we did a night march with a troop of mortars. The road was, a track had been made for us by the engineers, and we had to walk our way in order to guide the vehicles and so on into a position ready for the next morning to shoot in for the for advancing forward companies onto this hill feature for the beginning of hoping to take it. And this went along quite nicely until about, I suppose it must have been sometime in the late morning. And I think it was the people involved at that time were the Northumberland Fusiliers and the Argyll and Sutherlands. And we got a fairly rare order, which is doesn't often happen to gunners, and that was we were given a target, and it was just gunfire, no number of rounds, no time. It was a case of carry on firing as fast as you can until you're told to stop. And I think it went on for 2 hours. And we had a RASC company supplying us with mortar bombs, which were so carefully encased that by the time we had fired, I think there was something in excess of 9,000 rounds from just four mortars, we had sort of mountains of discarded wrappings and boxes and so on beside each gun. And we had to start taking the guns out of action one mortar at a time, because the barrels were getting so hot that when we placed the bomb into the top, the secondaries, which are the propellant charges, which are held between the fins of the bomb, is only a sort of cellophane cylinder. That's all its protection is. And the barrel was sufficiently hot to ignite these before they got to the firing pin at the bottom of the barrel. So we were having to take one piece out at a time and cool them off with water or any other sort of means, and then when that was cool enough, put that back into action and take another one out. We were also feeling a little bit exposed, because we were sitting in the middle of a flat little valley in a very shallow stream bed, which must have given us cover of all of 2.5 feet, I think, which isn't much fun. We could virtually see where we were, our target. We were rather expected to have something back at any time. But we got away with that for the rest of the day. And as soon as it began to get a little bit dusk and we had a chance to come out of action, we moved very sharply out of this rather flat valley and got into the lee of a hill, which is always a favourite place for a mortar, because it takes a mortar to hit a mortar, and it being an upper trajectory weapon, that's where you want to be. You sort of feel, well, he can have a go now because he can't get into us. He's got to... It'll fall beyond, if you see what I mean. And
so you didn't have any incoming fire?
We had none until after we'd moved in. We got into action again right up under the side of a hill, and that was the first night that I actually experienced receiving shell fire. And they did shoot into this valley, and they got as close as they could to us. We were facing the enemy. The hill was on our right-hand side, and we were firing in a sort of a diagonal formation. The guns were almost in a line, shooting over one another's heads in order to take advantage of the lee of the hill. And beside us ran the sort of forward communication track. Our ammunition had come up, and as it came up in 2.5-ton loads, we had stacked it beside the road in its boxes, ready for use. And beyond that, the helicopter for evacuating wounded and casualties had been taking people out all during the hours of daylight. And then just after dark, this shelling started. Whether they were looking for us or whether it was just harassing fire or not, I don't know. But they managed to get fairly close to our stacks of ammunition. And in fact, the odd shell splinter went through the boxes and set off the secondaries in the ammunition. And odd splinters wanged around amongst the gun positions. And the command post truck, which we hadn't had the opportunity to dig in or anything at that time, and our wireless vehicle and command post truck was on the gun position with a duty signaller sitting in it, who was one of the old Zed reservists. And I remember thinking that each shell that came in was a personal shell, and I was very flat on the ground in the dark, and thank God I hoped nobody else could see me. And behind a very small tree, which couldn't have been more than 3 inches in diameter, I shouldn't think, and the old Zed reservist, who was sitting up in the truck in a very exposed position manning the wireless set, had his usual large mug of enamel tea, enamel mug full of tea on the wireless set beside him, and one of these splinters went through the canvas and threw his enamel mug and ruined his tea, much to his annoyance, and some pretty abusive language that came out at the time. But it wasn't very, I don't suppose it was more than about a dozen rounds came in, and none of them did any harm to anybody other than that. And that was my first baptism of shell fire, anyway, as opposed to small arms fire.
How long did this Operation Commando go on for?
Oh, it must have been for, I suppose it might have been 3 weeks or so, 3 or 4 weeks. And there was a certain amount of shuffling and movement along the line. I think there was an American Marine, I don't know whether it was division or what size of unit it was, who were right over on the west side of the coast, which was a lot of islands and water and what have you. It was a very broken coastline there, which was suitable, I suppose, to Marines. And then between their right flank and our left flank as a division, I think there was a Korean unit. They were taken out of the line, and we sidestepped to the left to take over their position, which meant that we were, some of the forward platoon areas were very isolated. They were right out on a limb, overlooking a tributary of the Imjin, which I think was called the Samichon, which turned due north at that area, and we could see right up through the valley, and we could see well into the Chinese lines. We could see their trench lines. We could see movement. We could see them where they were digging. There were places, one of their tricks for, at this time, their artillery was becoming extremely effective, and one of their ways of doing it was to literally, by sheer manpower, dig a gun position through a hill so that you could pop your gun out on the shooting side, fire your rounds, and if it became particularly offensive, they knew that we would have some pretty accurate counter-bombardment would come to bear on them. And they could merely pull back inside the hill and keep their gun intact, ready for the next time. The other counter-bombardment way of doing it was, of course, just to call in airstrikes, which were done by ground controllers who would be with us. And they would have it all laid out on a map. They would have direct wireless communication with the aeroplanes, who would come in on a certain time, armed with certain all particulars of whether they'd got napalm or rockets or 200-pound bombs or what have you. And they would then be directed by the ground controller onto specific targets, which was sort of a form of airborne artillery, if you like. These were very effective and very dramatic to watch from the ground, and I think that if anybody was caught in the open, pretty effective. But for people who were dug in to the ground, and the Chinese were always extremely well dug in, I don't think it did an awful lot of harm, except in the occasions when they used this ghastly napalm stuff, which is petroleum in a jelly form, which probably covered an area of about 300 yards by 100 yards in very high temperature exploding petrol. And if it didn't burn you, it suffocated you because it evacuated all the oxygen. And that was a most dramatic sight to see that stuff come down. I mean, it came down in a can and would bounce on the ground and spread right along. And any soldiers caught in the open, that sort of situation, I wouldn't have a hope in hell.
What about if you're undercover?
Well, you've got chances there, hopefully, if you're not, the petroleum stuff would not, it was not sufficiently liquid to run, but it stuck, being like a jelly. So that if you were in a proper dugout and with overhead cover, the actual evacuation of air, I suppose, didn't take longer than 3 or 4 minutes. And then the thing would, except for a little bit of flame here and there where it was burning something which it had caught fire, you would have your oxygen back again. It was a pretty quick, instantaneous thing, and a conflagration which lasted that length of time. After that, if you'd survived that long, you were all right. Some people seem to think that if you ever got caught like that and you had a chance to pull a ground sheet over yourself, you might survive, but I have my doubts.
Did you ever see any napalm casualties?
No, I never. I don't think I ever saw more than half a dozen Chinese prisoners in the entire time I was there. They were very few and far between.
What did the prisoners look like that you saw?
Well, they were all of small stature. They all had their clothing consisted basically of cotton quilting, and they all wore gym shoes. That which was, I think, the thing that struck us more than anything else, because in the winter, you were getting anything down to 30 degrees of frost, and they wore quilted cotton trousers, quilted cotton jacket, a cap with earmuffs and a sort of back and front flap, and a pair of gym shoes. Oh, not gym shoes, like basketball boots. They had an upper to them, an ankle piece as well. And that appeared to be all their clothing. Their underclothing was sort of minimal. And we were damn cold, and how they survived, I don't know. But otherwise, they seemed wiry, adequately fed, and what have you. Otherwise, they seemed to be, I should say, ideal infantry fighting soldiers, because their standards of living were extremely low. They could make themselves comfortable with the minimum. If they had to lie out in the open in order to gain surprise, they were prepared to stay there for 12 hours in the most frightful conditions. They were prepared to lie there and relieve themselves without moving, which is what they did at the Imjin crossing at that time. They reckoned that they were on the bank of the Imjin in the open for something in excess of 12 hours before the crossing and the attack, and the build-up was never seen because nobody ever moved. And this in under primitive conditions is the ideal infantry soldier, a man who can shoot and endure conditions like that and survive with the minimum of nourishment and comfort. He's a hell of an adversary.
Did they show any signs of frostbite, these POWs?
I think none that I ever saw, no. I think they must have done, though, otherwise. But they never, it was very rare to ever find, although very heavy casualties were on many occasions inflicted on the Chinese, they generally managed to take their dead away all the time. They never left bodies about if they could possibly avoid it. There was one occasion where I didn't witness this, this was only purely hearsay, that there was during the Operation Commando, after about 10 days, there was a low hill feature in one of the valleys, which was held by not more than, I think, a couple of platoons. But for some unknown reason, this was considered very vital ground by the Chinese, who mounted several very, very heavy attacks on it, night attacks. And it was a very steep-sided little feature, and it had been well dug in, and with trenches all the way around the top. And apparently unit was that it might have been the Leicesters, it might have been the Leicestershire Regiment, I think. And they got to the stage where they knew that these attacks were going to come in at night, and there was only one way to do it, to repel it, and that was with 36 grenades. And they had truckloads of 36 grenades were brought up by daylight, lugged up to the top of the hill, and the whole of the trench line was filled with boxes of these things, which were opened up, fused, and then they undid the base plate of one grenade halfway, took the base plate out of the second grenade, and screwed it on, so every grenade was a double grenade. And when the attack started, they literally heaved the lot over the edge and rolled them down the slopes. And the casualties caused amongst the Chinese were, they reckoned that the engineers were sent to bulldoze this lot to clear the bodies. They couldn't, it was such carnage, but I don't know about that. I mean, whether that is hearsay or not, I don't know. It sounds a good story. But I know that this was a standard practice with grenades, which was something which was, I'd never heard of before. I mean, the sort of thing you'd think came in the First World War, which was the great Battle of the 36 Grenade, where it started its life. But it was a very useful weapon on that particular occasion, I believe.
When you saw these POWs, what did their morale and demeanour seem to be like?
Well, I think you can't tell in particular with people like that, because whether they're Indian, Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Malayan, they have a certain inscrutable expression of... They don't give away any sort of feelings. They don't show nervousness or anything else like that. They could have been... taken them out of their distinguishing clothes. They could have been just anybody. I mean, there was no sort of fear or nervousness or anything like that to indicate that they were prisoners or anything.
How were they treated?
Oh, perfectly all right. You know, they'd be sort of sent along, walking along, and there'd be one soldier sort of walking along behind them, taking them back to the POW cage or whatever it was. But as I say, I never saw more than, I think, the greatest number I ever saw were two. At the same time, I mean.
Now, coming back to Operation Commando, are there any other incidents or observations you'd like to make about your own role in this?
Well, the only other incident that I can think of was that we had, I don't remember, I think we, from the position where I was, one of our other troops was going to leapfrog and go forward from where we were, and the track that had been made, which wasn't our of our making beyond there, it was a Chinese track, because they used mechanical transport quite a lot at night to service their forward areas. This track went up past our gun position and up a valley. It was quite narrow. The valley was under shell fire, and this other troop had gone forward through it and taken up their position, and we had to... I can't remember what the actual conditions were, but one of their vehicles had broken down or something like that, and anyway was sent on up to this gun position and met another vehicle coming back. It was a narrow road, and so pulled off the road a bit and exploded a beer box, which was a makeshift landmine, if you like, which was partly buried at the side of the road, and which unfortunately blew the entire windscreen through the heads of the driver and his mate in the front of the vehicle. And they were brought back to our gun position, and they just, you know, they were still alive. But their heads were just a sort of great bloody mess, you know, on top. But one of the big things with the, I think, which was a big innovation, really, in the Korean War, was the evacuation of casualties. I mean, the Normash television program is, not only does it show the country very much as it was, but not Normash. Normash was our particular medical hospital, which was the Norwegian Medical Advanced Surgical Hospital or something like that it stood for. But in MASH on television, that program shows the countryside as it very much as it was, and the layout of the hospital very much as it was, with the tents and the helicopter pads. And the helicopters used to take casualties out of very advanced forward areas terribly quickly. A soldier could be badly wounded and back in the hospital almost within 20 minutes and on the table, which was a tremendous morale booster to anybody. They had pods on the side, which must have been very frightening if you weren't if you were aware of what was happening, because you were laid in a thing like a round-topped coffin, and then they clasped the lid down over you, and you're outside the helicopter on the landing gear, one on each side, and whipped straight back into the hospital. But it meant that people were back and being seen to very, very quickly. Also, the Americans used the helicopters. They had rocket launcher batteries out there. I suppose a thing looking rather like a gun limber with about 30 tubes on it. And they used to load these and then put it underneath a helicopter. And we, on one occasion, I was going up along a valley which was more or less running parallel with the line, and four of these helicopters came overhead, each one with a rocket launcher hanging underneath it. And they just pulled up behind the back of the forward companies, dropped these rocket launchers on the ground, they lined them up and fired them, and they were already loaded and set, and the four of these put off something like the equivalent of about 100 pound shells in about 3 minutes, and they up sticks and went away again. It was all gone and done, which the Chinese weren't terribly quick in counter battery or anything like that, but I think probably as things developed, if that happened, you happened to be the forward company and somebody came and sat just behind you, and this is an age-old problem, fires off a lot of rounds and then goes away again and leaves you to get the return issue. They're not very popular, but it was a nice inventive bit of artillery which I'd never seen before or never occurred to me. Just, you know, quick mobility, down, bang off a lot of fire and away again, which was quite interesting to see.
What about helicopter accidents? Did they occur frequently?
Never saw one. The only accident I ever heard was a Canadian who was a helicopter pilot who eventually joined. We had a flight of air observation pilots flying Austers at divisional headquarters, and we had Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, British pilots there, and this Canadian chap had lost his finger. I think it was his, I don't know, whatever finger they wear a signet ring on, or his graduation, you know, these big graduation rings they wear. And he'd got out of his helicopter and the prop had nearly stopped. And he put his hand up just to sort of slow it, bring it to a halt. It almost had come at a halt. And his ring caught in a countersunk hole in the helicopter thing. And being heavy, and although it was only just moving, it carried on. It just pulled his finger straight out. That's the only helicopter accident I ever met at all.
Now, coming back to Operation Commando again, is there anything else we should say about it?
No, I think it with the final taking of 355, and then the Americans took it over, and that formed the sort of limit of what was a limited operation. We got the sort of Samichon in the front. It gave them a line then, and they were sort of happy to sit there then with the peace talks then going on, which then started at about that time. It also, the winter, more or less, I know one shouldn't say that offensives stop in winter, but in that sort of climate, it has a hell of a bearing on it. It doesn't. You can't sort of have an all-out offensive when you've got the sort of starts off in the late autumn with very heavy rains, and then you get this these frosts that come on, which make it very difficult going for the tanks on hilly side, because if they try to go, they're all right going up and down, but they can't go across because of their tracks, which form toboggans, and they just literally skate. And the engine used to freeze sufficiently for Centurion tanks of 50 tons to be quite happy to go right across it. And that's not going across a few yards of ice, it's going across half a mile of ice.